top stories this hour, Saudi Arabia carries out a series of air raids in and around the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon says she wants to hold a second independence referendum as soon as next year. Also in the headlines, Russia registers another record in its daily coronavirus infections that raise total cases to over 2.2 million. Welcome to the program. As I said in the headline, Saudi Arabia has carried out a series of airstrikes on Yemen. The attacks targeted the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Still no word on possible casualties. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, most of them civilians. Millions more have been displaced. The conflict has caused a dire humanitarian situation in Yemen, with the UN calling it the worst crisis in the world. Supporters of Iraqi cleric Muqtada as-Sadr have filled the streets to voice support for him ahead of the country's parliamentary elections in Baghdad, of course. Sadr supporters hit the streets in the capital, Baghdad. Like I said, they held signs and waved Iraqi flags to show support for the Sadr movement. Muqtada as-Sadr has said his party will participate in parliamentary elections slated for January of next year. The Sadr movement is seeking to gain a majority. According to a new Iraqi law, a party with a majority of seats in parliament can form a new government. We'll discuss this, what it means for the future of the Iraqi politics and what it means for those people to be on the streets as of today. I'm going to bring in Mr. Said Mahsin Abbas. He's a journalist and commentator who joins us out of the British capital of London via Skype. Said Mahsin, how do you understand this recent developments?
Well, I think it's significant that one party could outright win the elections and rule. I think that's a really important development, given that in the past, there's been a lot of this kind of wheeling and dealing between different blocs, which is not an ideal way of running any country, because you can't get decisions done. Everybody's trying to hustle for their own piece of the pie, or the action, if you like, within Iraq. And that gives opportunity for the likes of the United States, particularly, to exploit those differences and exploit those kind of political interests of the indigenous, if you like, groups, which quite often base their politics on tribalism or on regionality or even religious grounds. The Al-Harar bloc, which is backed by Sadr, got 34 seats in 2014 election, and they fought on the anti-corruption ticket, really, and that's what they primarily pushed. But the real problem, ultimately, whether it's the Al-Harar bloc or whoever comes into power, is American interference in Iraq. That is, without a doubt, the fundamental problem. You know, the only reason the Americans have just recently withdrawn, or they said last week that they're going to withdraw 2,200 troops, is because the rocket barrages that have been coming in from a lot of the people who are actually fed up with the American interference in Iraq have got to the point where actually the Americans are getting a message. But of course, one can't trust the U.S. You know, they said they would support the Kurds in northern Syria. They pulled out. They said they would tackle ISIS, when in fact they're the ones who produce ISIS and let them loose in Iraq. They say they're going to rebuild Iraq, but they did none of that at all. I mean, Iraq is in a terrible condition, with unemployment, psychological problems, with a collapsed economy. Not only that, the Americans are blackmailing the Iraqi government with a $65 billion dollar fund, which they should give to the Iraqis but refuse to, as basically a sort of a gun to the head to any Iraqi prime minister. So quite clearly, the American interest in terms of controlling Iraq and using Iraq for its own ends is the fundamental issue which any government that's coming in has to tackle, I'm afraid. Mm. And if they don't do that, everything else is a waste of time, because it's the same American government which funds Kurdish dissidents. It funds people to stand up against the Iraqi government itself. It undermines its security interests. It will let loose ISIS again, just like it did before, and it is already doing that.
I really appreciate it, Said Mohsen. I'm going to have to leave it there. I enjoyed speaking to you and your analysis of the situation. That's Said Mohsen Abbas. He's a journalist and commentator, a regular contributor out of London via Skype. The United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees announces that it is hit by an unprecedented financial crisis.
For the first time in the history of the agency, we have no cash available anymore to cover our spending between now and the end of the year.
Philip Lazzarini, the Commissioner General of UNRWA, says the agency has received the lowest level of contribution since 2012. This is while the coronavirus pandemic is exacerbating the needs of the refugees. The agency relies on funds from UN member states and the European Union, but its finances have been ravaged by a U.S. decision to slash hundreds of millions of dollars of aid. Lazzarini also warns the health system in Gaza is about to collapse due to the coronavirus pandemic. Gaza has been under an Israeli enforced blockade since 2007 and is experiencing a deteriorating economic situation. Political commentator Zafar Bangai says U.S. projected winner by a media account to Joe Biden, and that's the presidential election, by the way, is unlikely to help UNRWA deal with its severe financial crisis, as he has proven to be a believing Zionist himself.
The Palestinians are now basically being abandoned, and they're being told that unless and until they accept the demands that the Trump regime had imposed, as well as the Netanyahu regime had imposed, that unless and until these Palestinians accept those demands, that they're going to be abandoned completely and they're going to starve in the refugee camps. So this is the stark situation that the Palestinian people face at the present time. And so what Joe Biden is going to do, we really don't know. I think we shouldn't hold too much hope, because Joe Biden is on record as stating that he is a Zionist, and he has said that if Israel did not exist, that America would have had to invent it or create it. So I think it would be unrealistic to hold too much hope that Joe Biden is going to take any steps that is somehow going to, he's going to do something that would benefit or help the Palestinian people.
Germany's total confirmed coronavirus infections has passed 1 million. Cases jumped after the Robert Koch Institute on Friday reported more than 22,000 new infections. The virus surge in the past few weeks has prompted Germany to extend a partial lockdown into January. Also on Friday, Russia registered a record high of more than 27,500 new cases. That pushes the country's total tally to over 2.2 million. Russia's death toll is nearing 39,000. In Ukraine, a record number of more than 1,600 daily cases were registered Friday. Ukraine's total infections now stand at nearly 694,000. Overall deaths are almost 12,000 there. Earlier, I spoke to our correspondent in Moscow, Marina Kortanova, about the sharp increase in daily coronavirus cases in her country.
So Moscow remains the leader in terms of the number of new cases. Over the past day, 7,918 cases were found here. In second place is St. Petersburg with half the figure. On November 26, Moscow authorities once again extended restrictive measures in Moscow in connection with the epidemic, and this time until mid of January, January 15, until the end of New Year holidays. So COVID hysteria forced tens of thousands of beds across the country to be registered, and a total of almost 500,000 health workers, doctors and nurses sent to the red zones.
It's time for our news review. Please stay with us. Greetings and welcome to this edition of News Review. British media say Scotland's First Minister seeking to hold a second independence referendum as soon as next year. Madame Nicola Sturgeon has said she anticipates the vote will take place in the earlier part of the next Scottish Parliament. That term begins next year. Scotland held its first referendum on independence from Britain, if you recall, in 2014. 55% of voters said no, but 14 recent polls have shown a majority of Scots now support independence. Such sentiment has gained momentum following Britain's exit from the European Union. Widespread criticism over the British government's handling of the pandemic is contributed to. London is against a new referendum in the near future. It says the previous vote should be respected. And that's what we'll be discussing in this edition of News Review with guests who kindly join us from London. I have Amina Taylor. She's our correspondent in the British capital, as well as Mr. John White. He's an author and commentator who joins us via Skype out of Edinburgh itself. Guests, very good to have you with us. I'm going to begin with London and, you know, the sentiment against it and, you know, the fact that London says it's soon. Is it?
Well, Westminster would say that, wouldn't it? Because quite frankly, they would have seen how the wind is blowing in this particular scenario. I was one of the leading correspondents who went up in 2011 when they were really pushing forward for even the right to be able to stage the referendum, because of course at that time the Conservative government was putting obstacles in place. This was just before Nicola Sturgeon's tenure here. And there were so many conversations about, even if Holyrood had the right to demand the ability to ask its own people about what should happen in terms of taking their destiny on board. And I do remember the polling at that time, it was around 60-40, and even that was some improvement. So it was seen as a long shot. Now, fast forward to 2014, when I was also on location in Scotland in the weeks leading up to that referendum, it was close. But one of the fundamental things that actually swayed it in the direction of no for independence was the fact that Scotland would be seen to be moving away from the European Union, with the European Union saying, listen, we don't really like separatist situations, as they don't for Catalonia and their bid for independence. So if you were to break away, well, you'd be pretty much on your own for a while. Well, they might not like to admit this, but the sands have shifted dramatically. You cannot have a Brexit scenario where Scotland overwhelmingly, I think about 56% of the total votes in Scotland, John might be able to correct me here on this, were definitely pro-EU. So you cannot have this situation where Westminster's pulling in one direction, Edinburgh's trying to pull in another, and the people of Scotland are trying to kind of be in that middle ground where London's calling the shots, but they're not respecting the wishes of those on the ground. I just don't see how this is tenable. I really don't.
Mm. John White in Edinburgh, of course, Amina made mention, and you know, true in that, you know, made mention of the issue of the Brexit scenario, and of course, you know, staying away from the European Union, not a favorable stance by the Scots. You're in Edinburgh yourself. Just tell us how the feeling, you know, back in 2011, 2014, there was no talk of Brexit, yet there was a referendum, and you know, so there are, it seems to me that there are, you know, factors above and beyond this issue of Brexit.
Well, the genie of Scottish independence is well and truly out of the bottle, and it's not going to be put back in again. The argument in favour of Scottish independence has been won. What's yet to take place is the political struggle by which to achieve it. I mean, it's absolutely correct. A main plank of the No campaign in 2014, the main argument was that if Scotland wanted to stay in the European Union, it would have to remain in the UK. And a lot of people were swayed by that argument. Nobody in their right mind would have believed that just 2 years later, in service to an emotional reach back in time to a supposed golden age when Rule Britannia was abroad and the Union Jack flew wherever it damn well pleased, that Britain would take this calamitous step of coming out of the largest free trading bloc in the world. And that's come to pass. So the game has changed. COVID has only accelerated the trend towards Scottish independence due to the shambolic handling of this virus by Westminster, opposed relative to Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, who's widely been perceived as being very competent and assured in her handling of COVID. So the argument's been won, the politics has been won in favour of Scottish independence. The UK is the very epitome of an artificial state. Different cultures, different histories, antagonistic in relation to England for much of their histories, Ireland, Wales and Scotland. And so the linchpin of the British state, the UK, was an industrial working class that cohered around the common trade union struggles. But the UK no longer is an industrial nation and no longer has an industrial base. And so the different cultures, regional and national, have now come to the fore, and that's been reflected in the politics and the votes, i.e. in terms of the Brexit referendum, where Scotland actually, 62% of Scotland voted to remain. That translates to every single one of Scotland's 32 local authorities. So it's Scottish independence is an idea whose time has come, but it's only going to come on the back of a very fierce political struggle next year.
All right. Amina, of course, you made the mention of... Sure. Go ahead.
The idea here that there is somehow some kind of joining of the political factions from Holyrood to Westminster, well, that's been exposed as a fallacy. We know that the Conservatives are widely despised up north, and also the Labour Party isn't really doing that much better in Scotland at the moment either. I mean, there were losses in the last two campaigns because Jeremy Corbyn flip-flopped a little bit on the issue of union, but did come down on the side of Britain staying as it was in these kind of four separate yet together nations. So I think the idea that there can be some kind of line of continuity because there is some link between Westminster and Holyrood, I just don't see how that would happen. I think Scotland is very much seen as its own entity. If you ask anybody here, and the idea that Westminster can demand that it stays anchored to the Downing Street ship just seems... ask any campaigner down here whether or not they want to admit this.
All right, guests, many, many thanks for joining us and discussing this with me. Amina Taylor, our correspondent in London, always well-informed and nice. John White, author and commentator from Edinburgh via Skype. I really appreciate the time you gave us this hour.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Iran Today.
Thank God Corona is kind to kids, relatively, because sanctions aren't. Kids with cancer are dying in Iran from lack of medicine, as mostly adults are dying in their thousands per month from COVID-19. US sanctions are killing people where the coronavirus wouldn't have. Trump's USA tried to blame the pandemic's death toll in Iran on the Iranian government for corruption and incompetence. But that only doubles the sins of the US for both unleashing medical terror on this country and blaming the victim. That's not to say Iran hasn't made its fair share of mistakes, but not much can compare to the toll US sanctions have taken on the economy of this country, and hence the fight on COVID-19. To trace where the blame leads to, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. To go off on a tangent, the US is one to talk about incompetence, with a president or outgoing president prescribing bleach as a corona cure.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number in the lungs, so it'd be interesting to check that.
Whatever incompetence Iran may have displayed, it pales next to that of the U.S., and Iran is in a quagmire. Maximum pressure economic sanctions cannot not have hit the economy. They have contributed to a drastic currency devaluation and high inflation. But not to tip the scales, let's begin with domestic causes of the disease having peaked in this West Asian state more than in neighboring states. Let's hear it from the dean of a successful hospital in Corona Care, who also has in his care kids with cancer. That would be Dr. Abul Ghassemi of Bariatullah Hospital.
The reason for the coronavirus spread in Iran was that we couldn't stop the source at the early stages. The best time to stop the virus from spreading was during the Iranian New Year's holidays. We should have taken more stringent measures like the ones in the Eastern Bloc. The model we chose was unfortunately from the West, and you can see how bad a situation they are in. We need to focus on the carriers of the virus. Testing hospitalized patients doesn't help much. Instead, we should go and test those who are healthy carriers and who have been in contact with them, and then give them facilities so that we can isolate them in hotels, provide them with vacant government houses, and use the money raised by charity to assist them.
Dr. Abul Ghassemi sees sanctions as a blessing as well as a curse. He takes pride in corona-related findings and domestic medicine that were achieved specifically to survive America's maximum pressure campaign. But that does not erase the greater evil.
Handling the coronavirus pandemic is not just a matter of providing medicine, but also a matter directly related to economics. That is, nations that want to control the crisis must have a stronger economy and stronger facilities. And these possibilities have been taken away from us by the West. They do not allow us to sell our oil. They do not allow us to take back the money foreigners owe us. They do not allow us to make our purchase on what we need, all of which have affected our economy.
Dr. Ghani is a lung specialist and on the COVID-19 Studies Committee. You know, the most common grave danger of COVID-19 is the lungs getting severely engaged.
It is true that we are producing diagnostic test kits, but the problem is that the Ministry of Health cannot afford all these kits. I mean, for example, you see some countries that were very strong economically tested one person twice, but we, for example, could test maybe 350 people out of 100,000. So the number of our tests was down because of the financial problems that were imposed on us. This clearly indicates it.
As the coronavirus made it to its first birthday, mid-November, it left in its wake the highest number of casualties Iran has yet seen. And from Saturday, the 22nd of November, the nation has gone into a two-week quarantine to be imposed. The government has announced quarantine of sorts in past, but it is not easy to maintain given the strain Iran's incarcerated economy has already endured. In the earlier days of the outbreak, when no one knew what they were facing, the world contributed to exacerbating the problem.
There were other practical mistakes made that don't necessarily relate to our country, but to the whole world. For example, they thought wearing face masks had no effect on curbing the spread. For a while, they said the transmission takes place through surfaces. And then they said for a while that the patients transmitted the virus, but then they realized that it wasn't entirely true, as they were isolated and everyone avoided them. We know today that most people who are infectious are seemingly healthy. Insufficient work was done on the matter, and not enough is being done now either.
In the earlier days of the outbreak, Iranian doctors boasted their success in improvising to help patients overcome the disease. Dr. Salehi, chief of the infectious diseases section of Imam Khomeini Hospital, has visited us again. This time, he laments losing the most patients ever to corona as a third wave of the virus surges on.
Why such fatality with COVID-19? Does it have to do with insufficient government measures or mostly people's non-observance of protocol?
As to why the number of deaths has increased and why the number of critically ill patients is so high, it is certainly due to the high influx of patients into the health system. If we are to assume that, for example, you have the ability to produce 3 TV shows a day, if it grows to 10 programs a day, how much does that impact the quality of your work? The same goes for us. For example, I have the ability to care for 30 patients a day. If this jumps to 90, I can't deal with my patients as carefully as I have to. This has actually happened. The main reason for the decline in the quality of the health system is a sharp increase in the number of patients.
According to official international sources, as of 23rd November 2020, globally, there are about 60 million coronavirus cases, about 1,400,000 deaths, and about 40,800,000 recovered. And in Iran, there are about 855,000 total cases, under 45,000 total deaths, and under 604,000 recovered. Like I said, there's been a surge in cases, and with more cases come more deaths, but also more treated. Treatment remains much the same.
We use antiviral drugs, for example, drugs such as favipiravir, remdesivir, and various other drugs. On the other hand, drugs such as dexamethasone and methylprednisolone are being used and have really helped some patients. But in general, none of these have been miraculous.
First of all, there is really no particular medicine to cure COVID-19, but there are procedures that we prescribe in clinical trials. One of the things we did to treat patients, like plasma therapy, was a project I started at this very hospital, and even the Americans started to adopt plasma therapy 2 or 3 weeks after us. Another important issue in handling COVID-19 patients is our oxygen supply. They even sanctioned us on this and refused to sell us oxygen generators. We started a knowledge-based company ourselves and produced oxygen.
But my question was, can patients get hold of the cure at reasonable prices? Because some hearsay reports paint a dismal picture. In August, the nation was angered by reports contrary to government claims. In April, the Iranian president Hassan Rouhani had said that the government and insurance department would pay 90% of treatment costs for COVID-19, leaving only 10% to citizens. Studies have shown that in private hospitals, the minimum cost of coronavirus treatment reaches 350 million rials. That's approximately $1,370 by the November 23rd exchange rate of 256,000 rials to the dollar. They say those costs can go up to 1.5 billion rials, which is under $5,900. And that is apart from the cost of private nurses and special medication. In public hospitals, on the other hand, treatment for insurance holders is almost free. But without insurance, a patient would have to pay between 50 and 300 million rials for treatment, which is close to $200 to $1,170.
We have a protocol in the scientific committee that you can prescribe certain drugs to people who are admitted. This is clear, so I will not discuss it. When we treat the patient with a scientific protocol, it costs us about 5 million 2 months, which is affordable. Also, the insurance pays, and the majority of our patients are insured, and we have a bed for them too. However, some private hospitals perform procedure for the patients that have not been approved by the scientific committee, and the patient is willing to pay any amount in such life and death situations.
Helpful medicine aside, the world is now moving towards using a vaccine. Question is, will Iran make its own vaccine soon enough? Because it's among the countries that have been working on it. If not, will Iran be able to place an international order and pay for it? Because we know that even if medicine were totally not under sanctions, Banking sanctions have been enough to block Iran's payment channels. Because countries, companies, and banks fear that dealing with Iran would expose them to secondary U.S. sanctions.
Iran prepared itself for both scenarios. If another country could produce the vaccine sooner, we can buy it until our own vaccine can be prepared. But I'm sure that the vaccine projects that we have been working on in Iran are close to the final stage. We do not have a problem in terms of their effectiveness. Our problem is to prepare them for the mass production and shipping stage to be able to use them for ourselves. Several projects that I know of are underway in Iran and have achieved very good results. I think we will definitely have an Iranian vaccine by next year.
We are expecting the COVID vaccine to be mass-produced pretty soon. Would you say that would be a reliable vaccine, and will Iran be able to place an order? Can we pay for it? Do we have the right channels, access to the right channels to pay for it?
Instead of vaccines, I think we should focus on more definitive precautions, such as using face masks, washing hands, and social distancing. The unilateral and irrational U.S. sanctions against Iran and some other countries is another reality we need to face. I am optimistic about these political changes that are taking place in the United States. If Mr. Joe Biden takes the power from Donald Trump and becomes the next U.S. president, it seems that, as he has said in his campaign speeches, he is ready to return to the JCPOA. So I hope we can have vaccines in Iran more easily.
Sanctions are an inseparable part of life to Iranians who have been isolated by Western terms for the past 40 years. But the first hard blow came 10 years ago with nuclear-related economic UN sanctions on this country. In 2015, those were eased and were to be lifted in stages by the JCPOA or nuclear deal in return for Iran limiting its peaceful nuclear program. Iran did so. But come Donald Trump, hopes were shattered for Iran and other parties to the deal. The U.S. unilaterally pulled out and reimposed U.N. sanctions as U.S. sanctions on Iran. Call it illegal to have the U.S. deny it. Before carrying on with sanctions, let's take a look at other media outlets to see what they've got on offer. For that, I give you Shahzad.
My name is Shahrzad Manoucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic, the U.S.'s blatant disregard for human lives. CBS News takes a look inside Iran's harrowing, sanctions-fueled coronavirus catastrophe. Iran is struggling with the worst coronavirus outbreak in the Middle East. Scientists at Tehran's Pasteur Institute are coordinating the national coronavirus testing efforts. Dr. Mostafa Salehi Vaziri's team managed to ramp up from just 10 tests per day to 30,000. It was an impressive improvement, but not enough to get control of the spiraling epidemic. The main hurdle for the lab hasn't been science, but politics. U.S.-led sanctions have choked off Iran's access to foreign-made chemicals and equipment. Vaziri has been forced to work with what he's got, which is a shortage of virtually everything. Tehran Times reports 75 lawmakers call on Trump administration to ease sanctions on Iran. Democratic lawmakers have urged the President of the United States to show leniency and allow coronavirus aid to be sent to Iran as the White House drew up a plan to step up sanctions on Iran in the remaining weeks of Donald Trump's first term in office. In a letter to Treasury Secretary and Secretary of State this week, Representative Jesus Choi Garcia and Senator Elizabeth Warren, along with 73 other House and Senate Democrats, called on the Trump administration to issue a worldwide temporary general license that would cover testing kits, respirators, and personal protective equipment needed to combat the COVID-19 pandemic, the Foreign Policy magazine reported. The pandemic has laid bare the ways in which our broad application of sanctions is undermining public health systems, imposing sweeping economic penalties that restrict commerce in the material and equipment necessary to respond to the coronavirus, and harming ordinary people, the lawmakers wrote. In an article by the Middle East Eye, we witness millions of Iranians at risk as U.S. sanctions choke insulin supplies. A new tranche of sanctions imposed by the U.S. on Iran has exacerbated the insulin shortage crisis in the Islamic Republic and boosted its smuggling, patients and doctors told Middle East Eye. Human rights advocates have warned about the devastating consequences of the latest sanctions on the daily lives of Iranians, including blocking their access to essential drugs and food. According to Farza Peyrouyan, the secretary of the National Academy of Health Economics, there are 4.5 million diabetic patients in Iran, 600,000 of whom need a daily insulin shot. That's all for this segment. We'll see you next week.
Sanctions has already cost Iran about $200 billion in revenues and helped devalue the currency by half in the past 2 years before the virus emerged. And it was mainly down to decimated oil sales. Modern Iran, after all, has traditionally been an oil economy. So the blow by sanctions, oil sanctions even, to the economy in the medium term, and especially while the country is struggling with a worldwide pandemic, should be obvious.
Isn't it more bad as time?
We are an oil producing country and we need to sell oil. When they created hurdles for selling our oil, we had only one source to take from, which was the Foreign Exchange Reserve Fund and the money we owed from abroad. So we did not have growing economy and did not have an economy with enough reserves. Well, to handle the coronavirus outbreak, shutting down the economy is needed. Elsewhere in the world, when they are under total lockdown, the unemployed are backed by insurance and will receive support.
Iran's crude oil sales of 2.5 million barrels per day, the U.S. tried to bring down to zero after pulling out of the JCPOA. That didn't happen. But Iran had to sell by running circles around the U.S., and that was up to only 300,000 to 400,000 barrels a day on a good day.
You said preventative measures such as wearing masks and washing hands were much better. Well, quarantining is one of those measures, isn't it? Why is it that Iran's economy hasn't been able to sustain a systematic, consistent quarantining?
Not only our economy, but also the economies of more developed and strong countries of the world, both in terms of economy and technology, have been unable to bear this. But I do not think we needed a long quarantine period. I think we needed timely quarantine, but not for a long time. We needed to announce lockdowns and eventually lift the restrictions carefully and with planning, just like what we did in April. Back then, Iran managed to rein in on new daily infections by imposing severe restrictions for 2 weeks, taking new cases to less than 100 people a day. But that plan was abandoned shortly after. As a result, unfortunately, we entered the second wave.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif tweeted that the U.S. had moved from economic terrorism to medical terror by declining to lift the sanctions after the beginning of the outbreak in Iran in mid-February. He urged the international community to stop aiding war crimes by obeying illegal and immoral sanctions. Iran's plea for sanctions to be lifted on humanitarian grounds during the outbreak has gained traction globally. But to the U.S., where sanctions failed, the outbreak succeeded. And now's the time to deal Iran that fatal blow while it's still down. To make Iran capitulate to U.S. demands, America not only didn't lift sanctions, but it doubled down, enforcing new sanctions, even as it offered Iran aid to combat the pandemic. Iran refused the aid, obviously, because in Iran's view, all the U.S. need do is lift sanctions as provided for in the nuclear deal, in which case Iran would need no aid. It could freely buy ventilators and so forth for coronavirus patients from any country it desired.
The bottom line is that the tough economic sanctions that the United States has imposed on our people have definitely affected patients. Acquiring pharmaceutical products and various diagnostic equipment, such as diagnostic kits, and radiological devices such as CT scans, MRI machines, and other equipment that need to be purchased from other countries is another important fact. To a large extent, these unilateral and highly inhumane sanctions seem to have seriously harmed our patients as well.
However much Iran may have suffered, the end result shows yet another failed policy on the part of the U.S.
While the U.S. could achieve some of its goals in short term, that is, it saw the impact of sanctions on Iran. But in the long run, this will be to the detriment of both the United States and its allies, because Tehran chose not to trust them in any way, neither in crisis nor in peace, and to base their trust on its only domestic production. All those which were generally import-based are now moving towards supporting domestic production. Their disadvantage is that, in the long run, they will no longer have a country with a population of 80 million as a market for their goods.
By April, Iran was already losing at least 1 million jobs per month. That's right. And economists said the coronavirus would shrink Iran's GDP, gross domestic product, by a third, and create at least a $10 billion budget deficit this year. People are suffering because a government lacking resources can't bail out businesses and can't keep up quarantines, because it can't financially support people so that they won't have to go to work. But the country is still standing. And anyone who doesn't believe they can seek corona treatment, just please refer to any of the good doctors and their hospitals, which I just introduced on the show. With the third or latest surge of the coronavirus, I have heard of people spending ₹1 billion on black market drugs and then hospital treatment. Compare that to ₹300 million, which is the maximum standard, more or less, in private hospitals. However, my own friends and one friend in each friend group caught the virus had no such experience. They may have not caught the strongest strain, but the treatment is the same and they got hold of enough drugs to get cured. And those who had to pay didn't have to break the bank. Aye, the greater number of patients treated corresponds with the greater number of cases infected and dead. And with overflowing hospitals and mass graves, doctors will be pleading for medical supplies, although they shouldn't have to, as under international law, a country or coalition of states enforcing economic sanctions should consider the impact on the human rights of the affected population, especially regarding their access to goods essential to life, including medicines and food. That's it for today. Thanks for joining us from the whole team. For now, it's bye.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Hussein, a book lover and a student of Tarbiyat Mudarris University of Tehran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, the avid readers of books, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You've tuned into IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The show is Bookshelf. And I'm Hussein. I'm here if you're looking for a good book to read this week. For any group or community, leadership might be the most important matter for their future. It is the leader, after all, who unites the group to make a single determined decision. Based on who the leader is, the course that the community or the nation shall take in the future will vastly change. Instead of all the warmongering leaders who led their people into murder and bloodshed, what if we had leaders who espoused justice, faith, and science? Upon the death of the Prophet, a dispute emerged among Muslims about who would succeed the Prophet as the next Muslim leader. While the Shia maintained that it was Ali as decreed by God through Muhammad's unequivocal declarations, the Sunni school believes that Muhammad introduced no successor to himself. Worse yet is leaders who later came and pushed their people farther from other Muslim schools, such that today some Muslims fail to identify themselves with other schools. What started as one nation under La ilaha illallah turned into several schools, each insisting they are right. The members of these communities fail to engage in a sensible dialogue while searching for a way to unite Muslims once again. It is our duty to find the true successor to the Prophet, because that is where we can start looking for the true Islam. But we don't have to be aggressive about it. We can respect each other's beliefs and engage in scientific dialogue in the process of looking for the truth. We look for the true successor to Muhammad in logic, miracles, and Muhammad's own words. Today, we're going to look at the evidence that points to Ali in the books of our Sunni brothers and the matter of Muhammad's successor. Stay tuned.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. Hubbu Ali al-Bayti fardun indana. Hubbu Ali al-Bayti fardun. وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Bookshelf, and we were talking about how important it is to find the true path to Islam. Today's book is called Shi'ism in Sunnism by Sayyid Muhammad Reza Mudarrisi Yazdi, published by Ansarion Publications of Qom and translated by Hamide Elohiniya. The book is a discussion providing evidence of Shia ideology and practice from the Quran and Sunni sources. Sayyid Muhammad Reza Mudarrisi Yazdi is a Shia scholar and one of the members of the Guardian Council of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I have the book in front of me right now. Like I said, it's called Shi'ism in Sunnism. The book comes in 118 pages. It begins with an introduction in regards to the recognition of the imams in the light of traditions. It talks about ijtihad and taqlid. It talks about wuzu, which is statutory ablution, in Allah's book and the Prophet's tradition. Tradition in heresy in adhan, or the call to prayer. Simultaneous performance of prayers. And prostration in the tradition of the Prophet and the companions. You can download this book for free from al-islam.org. We're going to take a short break now, but after the break, we're going to be back to read an excerpt of this book. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Bookshelf, and we're about to read an excerpt from the book Shiism in Sunnism by Sayyid Muhammad Reza Modarrisi Yazdi, which you can download for free from al-islam.org. I'm turning to page 95, which is about simultaneous performance of prayers. One of the issues which is of great attention to the observers and is especially evident in places of pilgrimage like Mecca and Medina is that most of the Sunnis, even their travelers, perform the five prayers at five distinct times, and the Shia perform them as Jam'a Taqdim or Jam'a Ta'khir. This difference is very astonishing for the public who are unaware of the traditional and jurisprudential issues, and also for most of the Sunnis who are used to differentiating between the five times. During the Hajj pilgrimage, I met a young salesman in Medina who was originally Turkish. He asked me, "Why do Iranians miss their evening prayer?" The simplest answer to persuade him in that short time was that at least they are travelers and it is permissible for them to delay the evening prayer and perform the evening and night prayers together. Further elaboration was not possible in that short period, but it can be deeply discussed with the scholars to inform people of it and hence eradicate some false opinions. This is of course possible if the scholars are not affected by the common habit and the status quo in the society, which unfortunately sometimes happens. Fossilization of ideas in the people's minds has basically been one of the major problems of the prophets in the course of history. The disbelievers are quoted in the Holy Quran as saying, "Nay, they say, we found our fathers on a course, and surely we are guided by their footsteps." That's chapter 44, verse 22. Both the Shia and the Sunnis should therefore know that some of their habitual rules, which are taken for granted, are not really self-evident in Islam. Rather, they have no true document. The reason for the existence of these common habits has been the verdict of great scholars in some cases and political considerations in most others. While the same rules had not been common previously and had just been some alternatives beside others. Surprisingly, these habitual rules are evident even in case of everyday duties of the Muslims, like ablution, prayer, and other rituals. So painful it is. Muslims who have seen the Prophet's ablution and prayer every day have so much disagreement even in a tangible issue like the cross position of hands in prayers. Some prohibit it, others know it undesirable, and others permissible, and still some others know it to be desirable. Some say the hands should be placed above the navel, others believe they should be beneath the navel, and it goes on. While the Prophet performed prayers five times every day before all the Muslims and said, "Pray as you see me pray." Whatever the reason for these controversies may be, and regardless of their justifiability or unjustifiability, it is evident that clarity of an issue for a certain group is by no means the proof of it according to the Quran and tradition. In this discussion, we are to discuss, based on what was mentioned, performing the prayers together and their exact time to make it clear that simultaneous performance of prayers is permissible in all conditions, according to authentic traditions of the Sunnis. In fact, the noon and afternoon prayers, and also the evening and night prayers, have the same time.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Okay, so that is a prelude to when the book gets into the verses of the Quran and traditions that are accepted by our Sunni scholars in regards to the subject, and the rest of the book follows the same method. That's all the time that I have. If you missed our program, I introduced Shiism in Sunnism by Sayyid Muhammad Reza Modarrisi Yazdi, which you can download from al-islam.org. You can also download an archive of this episode and all our previous episodes from our website. Simply search IRIB English Radio Bookshelf. Until next week and a lot of studying, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.